This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Damaged Like Us, written by Krista Ritchie and Becca Ritchie, performed by Alexander Sindice and J.F. Harding. 1. Maximoff Hale. "You can't tell me one thing about him?" I ask for probably the millionth time. I haven't actually been counting. But from Akara's annoyed bite into his blueberry bagel, I'm guessing my question died a bitter death 5 minutes ago. Today is doomsday. The day where my unconventional, strange life becomes colossally more complicated. I can handle shitstorms while propping up the earth with one goddamn hand, but I'd like to be semi-prepared for situations. I have a real switchblade in my fucking pocket, but I want a metaphorical one too. Akara swallows his bagel. "You want one thing?" "Just one," I affirm. "He's your new bodyguard." I slowly blink into a glare. "Thank you for offering me the one thing that I already fucking know. It's the one thing that's been driving me up the wall like a possessed Spider-Man. I've had the same bodyguard for my entire life, and he decided to retire recently. Just yesterday, I said goodbye to Declan. It's bittersweet. He wants to spend more time with his wife and two kids, not be the 24/7 bodyguard to an internationally famous human being. I get that. Selfishly, I wish he could stay longer. And when I mean longer, I mean forever. Personal bodyguards are like spouses. All of my immediate and extended family have one. They follow us everywhere, eat with us, guard our rooms if we bring home strangers, or, in my case, uncomplicated hookups. Mind-blowing fucks. One-night stands. All of that is being passed to a new someone. I've never had to introduce a new bodyguard to the ins and outs of my life. It's not just going to be a day in the life of Maximoff Hale. It's a permanent position that'll last decades, unless he turns out to be an incompetent prick. This pivotal moment has put me on edge because Akara, the lead bodyguard in Security Force Omega, refuses to share more information about him. "Like I said an hour ago," Akara tells me, "it's better if you meet in person." Before I can reply, his cell phone pings. I hope it's my new bodyguard. I check my canvas wristwatch. He's 20 minutes late, and Akara already assured me that he received the invite. Location: Superheroes and Scones. Time: 6 a.m., before the store opens at 8 a.m. The homey but massive store is empty. I only turn on a few lights since no employees are here yet. The place quiet, dimly lit. While I wait, I stand behind the bar counter and pour myself an orange juice. I'm not stealing. My family owns the two-story hybrid comic book store and coffee shop. With red and blue vinyl booths, stools, and then rows and rows of shelved comics and merch, Superheroes and Scones resembles a retro diner and modern comic store. 85 of them exist throughout the globe, but this one in Philadelphia is the very original. Since its creation, it's had a few major renovations. The second floor used to be offices for a comics publishing company, which has since moved next door. Capping the jug of juice, I look to my right. Bright blue stairs twist towards a second-floor loft area, littered with colorful beanbags, sofas, coffee tables, and mounted televisions that play superhero films nonstop. If I could rank my favorite places in the world, Superheroes and Scones would be number 2, right behind a pool. Any pool. I take a large swig of my OJ and Akara's phone starts buzzing in quick succession. I wipe my mouth on my carved bicep and notice the text message boxes lighting up his screen. "Someone's popular." That better be my tardy bodyguard. Akara wipes his fingers on a flimsy napkin. "It's only one person." I crane my neck to try and see if I can spot a name. Akara angles the phone towards his chest and scrolls through the messages. "Chill. Eat. Try not to overthink if that's at all possible for you." It's not. I can fucking admit this. Akara smiles but concentrates on his phone. Pieces of his straight black hair touch his dark eyelashes. His cut muscles could tear through his blue Studio 9 shirt. There's no uniform for security detail. Bodyguards just typically dress for the occasion. Like when I attend formal charity events, they'll wear suits and tuxes. I roll my shoulders backwards, muscles tight. I need to stretch, swim several laps. I check the time on my phone. Then I take another swig of orange juice and watch Akara text. You know, I tell him, I'm not asking for the meaning of life or a planetary map of undiscovered galaxies. You could give me his hair color, zodiac sign, maybe a last name? Nice try. Akara's brown eyes lift to mine, just to say you can't bullshit me before he returns to his cell. Why don't you finish making your list for him? I already printed it out. It's in the pocket of my jeans. Akara suggested I bullet point the rules of my life for the unknown person. Like number 32. I take pictures with fans in real time and let them post the pics. Not all of my cousins or siblings allow this. It gives the public and media a timestamp of where I am, and it's considered dangerous. A safety threat. But I've lived my life beneath a spotlight since I was in the womb. I don't give a shit if someone knows where I am at so-and-so time. Chances are paparazzi will find me anyway. After placing my glass down on the bar, I rake a hand through my disheveled, light brown hair. The strands are dyed from their natural dark brown hue. I know that you know what I look like. You've seen my face on the front page of tabloids, all while you were checking out 2% milk, maybe a Kit Kat bar, hopefully a can of fizz. I have forest green eyes that dagger the souls of those who fuck with my family. Sharp cheekbones that look like knives, and a lean-cut swimmer's build from my competitive swimming days. You may not know that Burberry and Calvin Klein scouted me when I was 18. I turned them down. Akara texts. And texts. For the past 5 years, he's been a central part of my life, even if he isn't my personal bodyguard. As the lead of Security Force Omega, he's in charge of hires, transfers, terminations, and keeping the whole system running. He's the glue. The constant. He's 25, Thai American, MMA trained but specialized in Muay Thai, and he owns the Studio 9 boxing and MMA gym down the street. People pack Studio 9 every morning, and evenings are impossible to get into without a referral. He glances up from his phone, eyeing me. You need to relax. I'm impatient, and I'm overly self-aware. Firmly, I tell him, if he doesn't show by 8, we have to leave. I can't be here when the store opens. I'll be stuck signing autographs and taking photos for hours on end, and I have a long, long list of things I need to get done. I'm a CEO of a charity organization that raises millions annually, and I set a goal to raise $300 million for HMC Philanthropies by December. We're not even halfway yet. He knows, is all Akara says. He knows. Who the fuck is he? I straighten up. Rigid like I'm seconds from joining the National Guard. Did you at least choose someone who can keep up with me? He's not going to sputter out after an hour or two. I constantly drive back and forth from my townhouse to my work offices and to the gated neighborhood of my childhood home, where my three younger siblings still live. Again, relax. Akara holds out a hand. I know you. I wouldn't put someone on your detail that can't handle your lifestyle. He pushes back his hair and then fits his baseball cap on backwards. Akara appears approachable right now, friendly, even. But I witnessed him staring down a grown 50-year-old man, twice his size, veins protruding in the man's ripped muscles, a known steroid user. He was also my cousin Beckett's former bodyguard. And he fucked up. He let a cameraman slip into a public bathroom while my cousin was pissing in a urinal. Akara laid into the bodyguard, yelling, scolding, and I just watched this much younger guy make a middle-aged man cry, tears just streaming down his face. Akara made him feel like he committed involuntary manslaughter. I realize that's why most bodyguards say, don't piss off the SFO lead. Pissing off Akara is like putting your ass on death row. Boom. Our heads whip to the tinted store windows. Four preteens just ran into the glass, bouncing on their toes. They scream a variety of names, mine included, and they cup their hands to the window, trying to peer inside. I smile. It's funny. If I thought it wasn't, I'd be irritated every minute of every single day. Typically, there's a line outside of the store until closing, so I'm not surprised people are already here before 8.
1, 2, 3.
They all count together before shrieking,
Maximoff hail!
My lips stretch wider. You, as in the four preteens and also the whole world, you all know me as Maximoff Hale, CEO of a nonprofit charity, One-time philosophy major, competitive swimmer, son of a sex addict mother and recovering alcoholic father, and the steadfast older brother to 3 and cousin to 11. You're obsessed with my perpetual single relationship status, and you've never seen me publicly date anyone. On occasion that I wasn't careful enough, you've seen photos of me bringing home random girls or guys. You know I'm not serious about them. You know they'll only last one night. Not one damn string attached. You don't know really anything about our bodyguards, like how they exist in our lives as close as family members. It's their duty to maintain anonymity with the public, and you can't keep an eye on them or know them the way we do. So you know nothing about Akara Kitsuon and the rest of Security Force Omega. Akara grins at the 3 girls and 1 boy who can't see us, but we can see them flailing excitedly and taking selfies. This shit never gets old. I raise my OJ. Immortal Entertainment. 2 homemade signs smack the window. I read one. Fuck me, Maximoff Hale. She looks 12. Pigtail braids and braces. My jaw muscle tightens. Just kidding. That's not fucking funny. It should go without saying, but I'd never have sex with a preteen or teenager or anyone who looks on the cusp of being that young. Jesus, 12. I have a sister that age. I'm not against hooking up with fans. It's pretty much inevitable. But it has to be A, consensual, and B, someone of legal age, and C, a one-time thing. Akara scrutinizes the preteens. The scary part, he says. That shit doesn't even faze me anymore. He eyes the lock on the store entrance before returning to his cell phone. The other sign from her friend, I want to have your babies, Xander Hale. Xander is my 14-year-old brother. My shoulders square, but I try to brush that sign off without a long thought. Akara resumes texting again. I lean forward, still not able to see his screen. Hot date? I ask. Akara quickly says, no. Then he removes his elbows off the counter. Sitting up. It's Sully. Sullivan Meadows. My 19-year-old cousin. Sully's blowing up your phone? I give him a look. Didn't you tell her that you're with me? I needed a bodyguard just to drive here and meet a new bodyguard. The irony. I asked Akara if there was anyone available from Omega, and he offered himself. I thought she'd be asleep until 9 at least. I wait for him to add more. He stops there. Why? I try not to snap. I swear the whole security team enjoys keeping me out of the loop. I could get twice as much information by just asking my family, but I restrain myself from texting Sully. It doesn't matter, he says evasively and eats another bite of bagel while messaging my cousin. It does to me. She's my family. She's not a part of security. She's on my side. Famous. 3 famous families. The Hales, the Meadows, the Cobalts are permanently bound together because our moms are sisters, the Calloway sisters to be exact. And the Calloways, namely my grandfather, founded Fizzle, a soda company so world-renowned that they beat Coca-Cola in sales for the past decade. Fizzle is part of why we're all famous, but it's not the whole story. I add, I can just text her myself. I reach for my phone, but he caves, nodding to me. Once he swallows his food, he says, she kept yawning on her way back from a state park. She didn't get home until 3 a.m. He sends another text. I should have known she'd wake up. His eyes flit to me. She has FOMEFT. Fear of missing every fucking thing. My lips rise. Sully coined it herself. The most predictable thing about my younger cousin is the least predictable thing. Sleep. I'd think it strange that Akara knows these details about Sully, but he's her personal bodyguard. He's been assigned to Sullivan since she was 16. If anyone knows her life habits, it's him. It hits me again. The thought I've been swatting away like a bee. Someone is about to know my life habits that intimately too. Great. I lean on the counter, arms crossed over my green crewneck shirt. And then my muscles bind as the lock starts to rotate on the tinted glass door. Someone is entering. Someone who is given a key. My new bodyguard. He's finally here. 2. Maximoff Hale. Dear world, stop fucking with me. Sincerely, an agitated human. The last person I wanted to see today enters Superheroes and Scones. I refill my glass of orange juice and watch the familiar face open the door. Towering at 6'3", his black V-neck is tucked in black jeans, a leather belt buckled. The hilt of a handgun sticks from his waistband, and his dyed bleach-white hair contrasts his thick brown eyebrows. Most people find Pharaoh Redford Keene intimidating at first sight, but I'm immune to most kinds of intimidation. It's called being a Hale. I can describe Pharaoh in three meaningful ways. One, frustrating. Two, aggravating. Three, piss in my hot tea. Since he's my mom's bodyguard and she stops by the store frequently, I expect she's not far behind his self-assured, unflustered demeanor. Pharaoh carries himself like he owns the world, but amusement constantly rests behind his brown eyes. I sometimes think he's purposefully channeling James Franco circa Freaks and Geeks, minus the weed, and multiply the Franco smile by a billion. It shouldn't capture my attention, but it does. He does. Like right now, I try to ignore his overwhelming presence, and I slowly cap the juice jug again. My gaze stays on him. No matter how hard I say, look at the juice. I've had this problem since I was 16. Unfortunately, I've known Pharaoh for a long, long time. I'm talking fledgling teenage years. Before the security team assigned him to my mom, he was just the son of our family's concierge doctor, on call 24/7 for house visits and medical emergencies. So when my little sister Kenny broke her ankle in 5-inch heeled boots, Dr. Keene appeared, with his son, Pharaoh, in tow. I tried to tug off Kenny's boot, and Dr. Keene told me, "Move away, Maximoff." Then he gestured Pharaoh forward, teaching his son basic first aid. Also, he could follow the footsteps of the many generations of Keens before him, a prestigious family of physicians. Moments like those stoked my competitive nature. If Pharaoh was pushed to the front, I craved to find a way next to him. If Pharaoh went fast, I went harder. And he never let up. With anything, he was too headstrong to let me pass without a hard-won fight. Somewhere around my 16th birthday, I started crushing on him. Maybe it's because he never just gives me the win. Maybe it's that he's 5 years older and a Yale graduate. Or that he does 30 pull-ups like it's a damn breeze. Maybe it's all the gray and black tattoos that cover his fair skin even to his throat. Beautiful, inked, symmetric wings decorate his neck. Crossed swords on his Adam's apple. Maybe it's his four visible piercings. A hoop on his nostril, bottom lip, and two barbells on his brow. Maybe it's all of that combined together that heats my skin, pools blood south, and attracts me like an idiot. He's made permanent camp in my cerebral cortex and cock, and I don't know how to extract him. The crush was fine when I was a teenager, when I was secretly fantasizing about the hot older guy's lips around my dick. I always knew he was gay, and at 18, I told the world I was bisexual. Afterwards, I thought there'd be a chance Pharaoh would look at me with interest. He didn't. Then he became my mom's bodyguard. Exactly 3 years ago. Whatever attraction I had towards him became more ethically wrong than it already was. I remind myself that he knows nothing. I've only told my best friend Jane about my crush and lapse in judgment. And she wouldn't tell a soul. Pharaoh enters the store's doorway and takes a big bite of a red apple. And then his brown eyes latch onto my forest green. Instantly. He has a knowing look. I attribute it to him being a know-it-all. I must wear my slight irritation because his lips hike upward as he chews and swallows his fruit. I swig my orange juice before saying, "Look what the wind threw up." I set down my glass. Pharaoh raises his apple to his mouth.
"You mean blue in?"
"No," I say firmly, palms on the pearly counter. "I meant threw up." He rolls his eyes into a humored smile that slowly stretches wider and wider. Then he kicks the door closed, and he locks it shut with his spare key. I go rigid. "Where's my mom?" Akara finally pockets his cell phone, the one he's been superglued to since we arrived here.
"Lily's bodyguard transfer went through this morning."
Transfer. Which means, my brain fries, Jaw sharpens and breath heavies as I watch Pharaoh near the vinyl stools, his stride masculine and unconcerned. A kind of confident gait that belongs to people who understand themselves from the core outwards. Closer, he rests his knee on the stool beside Akara, and he tells me,
I'm your new bodyguard.
I inhale, staying outwardly composed, but my pulse rages at an abnormal speed. Pharaoh Redford Keene is my new bodyguard. I have trouble adding him to my life that way. It's why I'm eerily silent and mentally trying to block out how complicated this will make everything. Pharaoh stares me dead in the eye.
Excited?
He asks with a peeking smile, like he knows I wouldn't be. Excited that my old crush is going to be a permanent companion to my whole life, and we're ethically bound to remain platonic. I would choose the words sexually frustrated and fucking complicated, but let's go with excited. It'll cause the least amount of friction right now. That's one word for it, I say and finish off the rest of my drink in one gulp. What's the actual reasoning behind this? I gesture at Pharaoh with my empty glass. The whole security team has good intentions, and I understand that a lot weighs into bodyguard switches. I can't just demand someone new like an entitled bastard. All the bodyguards work together, and they're people, not plastic action figures. I respect them enough to trust their choices. And it's not like they knew I used to picture Pharaoh on his knees. It's not like they'll ever know that.
The usual, Akara says. We take into account the location of where you live, a townhouse in Philly, your lifestyle, on the go, other security variables, and then we match you.
So it's bodyguard grinder without the sex. I quip and try to ignore Pharaoh, but my eyes involuntarily flit to him. Pharaoh raises his brows at me in a self-satisfied wave. I want to groan and smile. My features, I'm sure, teeter between the two.
We're not going to promote it like that, but sure, basically, Akara says.
Basically, Pharaoh interjects. Lily wanted me to be your bodyguard.
Lily is my mom. Akara zeroes in on Pharaoh with an intense but padlocked look. I can only assume that Pharaoh wasn't supposed to give me that much information. He even adds,
word for word, she said, Pharaoh is the best.
Bullshit, I tell him. My mom would cross her heart and hope to die before saying anyone was better than Garth. Her first ever bodyguard. I'd never seen her so emotional over anyone's departure than when he retired. Pharaoh rotates his apple for another spot to bite.
Then she broke a kindergarten oath for me.
His matter-of-fact voice is deep and rough, but audibly sensual, like gravel tied in silk. My muscles heat from head to toe. Wow, I say, my tone too tight. My head is somewhere else entirely, on this situation, our new reality, him. Pharaoh lowers his apple, and my cheekbones must sharpen because his brown eyes brush my most distinct feature. I seize his gaze, and in our sudden quiet, a thick tension brews. Both of our lives are going to change from this transfer, and there's an unknown factor. I can't even conceptualize what Pharaoh as my bodyguard looks like. I sense Akara glancing between us, gauging how well we're getting along. But his answer is as good as mine. And I have no answer. I have no idea what it's like even cultivating a new relationship with a bodyguard. I've had the same one for practically 22 years. Pharaoh tosses his apple core in a nearby trash can. Then he drops his knee off the stool, his shoulders noticeably loosened unlike my squared ones.
Let's start with the basics, Wolf Scout.
Of all the things, you can call me. But it never stops Pharaoh from choosing this. My aunt created the Wolf Scouts as a wilderness and survival scouting organization that includes all genders. It gained national recognition, and yeah, I still help in the summer as a troop captain. And what basics?
The basics.
He edges up to the lip of the counter, his face only a few inches from my face.
Every time you leave your townhouse, I'll be escorting you. I walk in front of you. I enter rooms before you. I go where you go until you return safely home.
I slowly blink, my skin scorching. Imagining Pharaoh with me all day, every day, this quickly, is like digesting a gallon milkshake in one gulp. I have a fucking brain freeze. I rub my jaw that's a razor blade. Pharaoh tilts his head.
Okay.
I'm making a revision.
To the basics?
He glances at Akara, and they share a look that I can't decipher. I bypass their exchange and continue. You walk into places beside me.
No.
Pharaoh rejects immediately. He runs two hands through his bleach white hair, combing the strands completely out of his face. Sometimes he does this to give himself more time to answer. Other times, I think it's a sign that he's getting serious. Akara rests his elbow on the counter.
Mafi, he has to assess the room before you enter, just like Declan did.
Declan isn't Pharaoh. My old bodyguard preferred privacy with me, to the point where I can't say I know very much about him personally. I know Pharaoh in a way that I never knew Declan. It instantaneously changes the bodyguard-client relationship that I'm used to. Then, when we're on the street, I say to Pharaoh, you walk beside me. You don't need to walk in front of me every single time like you're my labradoodle.
A labradoodle, he repeats,
his features balancing on the peak of an eye roll and a laugh.
You couldn't have picked a more docile animal, could you?
Before I can respond, he adds,
I'll consider that, but I can't promise I'll follow through in every situation.
That seems fair. I nod a couple times. When did you find out about the new assignment? He looks unaffected, but if he were a superhero in a battle zone, the comic book panel would show Pharaoh relaxed on a destroyed bench, using his powers to easily survive and make do. In comparison, I externalize my readiness for shitstorms, my back straight, shoulders stringent, and head hoisted.
I was told last night, he says.
I let this sink in. So only 8 hours more than me?
12, technically.
His lips begin to lift like he beat me at something. I holster my own smile. Thank you for that technical adjustment.
Anytime, Wolf Scout.
He eases forward and lowers his voice to the sexiest whisper.
It's good to remember that I'm better than you at most everything.
It takes a lot of effort not to stare at his mouth. Sounds like an alternate universe. One corner of his lip quirks, and then he eases back.
Boom!
Our heads whip to the store windows. More people bang against the glass as they try to peer inside. Others chatting loudly as they wait for superheroes and scones to officially open. We need to go, I say the obvious. It really dawns on me that the we in this scenario is me and Pharaoh, not me and Akara, not me and a guy I recently met. It's just me and him. And not in a way I fantasized. Pharaoh is now obligated to protect me, maintain a professional relationship with me, and always keep me safe. Picturing a polar bear eating Fritos on the moon is easier than imagining Pharaoh as my bodyguard. I think it's a sign that this is about to get fucking strange. 3. Maximoff Hale. Leaving superheroes and scones in my red Audi, I merge onto the freeway. The air is noticeably strained between us since I gave him my 8-page list. While he silently reads in the passenger seat, I concentrate on the road and speed past paparazzi vehicles that attempt to hug me like we're friends. Pharaoh glances up and scrutinizes the various SUVs and sedans racing after us.
I really should be the one driving in this relationship.
I stiffen at the word relationship. I mentally add in platonic, but my 16-year-old self with his sophomoric crush would be hard as a rock right now. 22-year-old me is still pissed that I put Pharaoh in my spank bank. Number 12, I nod to the list. He eyes me for a long moment before focusing on the paper.
It says that you're not used to letting other people behind the wheel.
It actually says I always drive. I glance at him once, then back at the road. I didn't realize that you can't read. I switched lanes. I could almost feel his smile stretch.
Always a precious smartass.
I hear him flip a page.
You have a typo on number 32.
He called me precious. What the fuck does that even mean, precious?
I have to let it go, but the word scrolls across my gaze like a ticker tape banner. What typo?
You forgot a comma.
I let out an irritated groan. This isn't a term paper. Don't critique my grammar. Pharaoh kicks up one of his shoes on the seat, balancing his forearm on his knee. Then he bites the staple off and spits it out. I tense and try to watch him and the road simultaneously. He has a very particular way he moves his hands. They shift with meticulousness and care, a sort of accuracy that belongs to surgeons and someone equipped to disassemble and reassemble a gun blindfolded. I've imagined those hands on me too many times to count. Don't fucking restart now. I'm trying not to, but having him this close, the NC-17 fantasies vie to breach the surface. Heat blankets my skin and tries to grip my cock. Thumbing through the papers, Pharaoh tells me,
"You're about to miss our exit."
Shit. He smiles, a self-satisfied, entertained smile. But I skillfully veer over three lanes of traffic and dodge more paparazzi, making the exit ramp safely. Pharaoh folds nearly all of the pages and only keeps two sheets. "What are you doing?" I ask. He waves the folded stack.
"How about you ditch 85% of your rules and be less of a wolf scout?" "Wolf scout?"
"No." I shake my head a few times. Those rules reflect my current way of living. This is my fucking life, Pharaoh.
"And you have to make room for me," he says seriously. "We'll find a groove together, but not when you put me in a headlock before the match even starts."
I honestly think he just hates being confined by strict rules that aren't his own. Declan followed them.
"To your detriment," he says bluntly.
"You have a speeding habit.
I should be driving."
We're on that again. "I drive," I tell him. "Your options are endless. Watch me drive. Watch the other cars. Watch the horizon. Count road signs. Play with the music."
"Inaccurate."
He licks his thumb and flips quickly through the pages before landing on one.
"Number 92. I prefer no music in the car until noon."
He tilts his head at me.
"Because?"
"I usually have to make business calls. For charity," I emphasize. He knows that I work nonprofit. Every day will be take Pharaoh to work day. It's weird. What's weirder is that he's currently working right now. He's not just in my car to chat. He's on the job.
"Are you planning to make a business call now?" he questions.
"No."
"Then really this should say, I prefer no music in the car until noon when I have business calls."
He pops open the middle console and finds a pen. He rewrites the rule.
"You also have another typo."
"Shut up about the fucking typos," I say, and adjust the air conditioner, my body hot as his smile stretches wider and wider. To fill the quiet, I switch on the radio and play an EDM station. Heavy bass pumps through the speakers.
"Music before noon," Pharaoh says. "I've already started loosening his straight laces."
One hand on the wheel, I use the other to flip him off. I love how you give yourself credit for the stupid things in life. It's so generous of you. Pharaoh almost laughs, but we both suddenly grow quiet and serious. Two paparazzi SUVs flank my sides and abruptly cut me off from a right turn.
"Get off Market Street," Pharaoh suggests.
That was my plan. I speed 40 over the limit just to pass the SUVs, but they have a Honda friend ahead of me. The blue Honda slams on its brakes, causing me to slam on mine. Fuck. I'm now boxed in, like a rat in a trap. I reach into my cup holder for my sunglasses, but Pharaoh is already handing me my black Ray-Bans, reminding me that he's trained for these situations. He slips on a pair of black aviators. Arms and cameras stick out of paparazzi's rolled down windows. I'm forced to drive at their speed, and flashes pierce me from nearly every direction. My sunglasses dim the brightness, but not my frustration. Most days I coexist with paparazzi fine. I'll answer their harmless questions, sign their photographs that they then sell on eBay, and we respect one another enough. Then they pull stunts like this, and I question the percentage of decent cameramen to the ones that had run my family into a ditch for a grand.
"Do you want me to help you?" Pharaoh asks. Or would you rather just let them capture photos of you glaring?
I gesture to the windshield. There's nothing left to do.
I'm not Declan.
Pharaoh unbuckles, and he leans over the middle console, towards me. My breath cages in my lungs, and I watch his arm slide across the back of my seat. With his other hand, he slams the heel of his palm on the wheel's horn, blaring into the morning sky. He extends his body even more over me. While I drive, he's careful not to block my vision of the road. But I'm more concentrated on the fact that his shoulder brushes up against my chest, and one of his knees sits between my legs. Pharaoh rolls down the driver's side window. He turns his head just slightly. Our face is literally a breath away. Focusing on the paparazzi, he yells,
"Tell the Honda to drive off or I'll shutter Maximov's windows."
Shutter, meaning he'll tape up sheets to block their money shots. The cameraman says,
"One more minute! Get out of the way!"
He makes a shoe motion to Pharaoh.
"Hey, now or never,"
Pharaoh threatens, his tone so caustic that I'm not surprised when the cameraman disappears inside his SUV. Moments later, the Honda takes a left, freeing the road, freeing us. I speed off as quickly as I can. Declan never had that kind of effect on paparazzi. It stuns me silent for a minute. Pharaoh eases back in his seat, and I roll up the window. He picks up his papers, and I glance at him, then the road, then back to him. He arches his brows.
"Want to say something?"
"Where'd you learn that?"
Pharaoh snaps his seatbelt locked. "When you're the bodyguard of the most famous woman in the world, you can't be a passive bystander."
"My mom. My mom is the most famous woman in the world. She's the reason her sisters are famous. The reason I'm famous. The reason we're all famous." Lily Calloway is the origin to the public scrutiny, the media harassment, the paparazzi invasion in Philadelphia of all cities. But it's not her fault. It's never her fault. I wish I could say our fame derived from a pure act of love, of kindness, of rainbows, or motherfucking magic, something other than what actually happened. But it was a scandal. Years before I was born. Someone leaked information when she was only 20 years old. Lily Calloway, the heiress of Fizzle Soda Empire, is a confirmed sex addict. The headline about her addiction rocked the globe. A salacious, shocking headline. That's all it took. The news caused every Calloway sister to go from rich obscurity to instant notoriety. Our fame burns, and burns. None of us need to stoke the flames for it to stay lit. And me, fame is my friend and foe. It's a part of me, a tangible thing that lives inside of me. This is the only life I've ever lived. It's the only life I know. These days, I currently reside with Jane in an old historic Victorian townhouse that's just shy of 900 square feet. All hardwood floors, interior brick walls, and a kitchen so cramped that a third person has to play Indiana Jones and scale the counters to fit. I'd live a more minimalistic lifestyle if I could. I don't need much. And I'd say the three-bedroom, one-bath is extremely modest for someone with my bank account. But I'm well aware that living in Philadelphia's Rittenhouse Fittler Historic District isn't cheap for most people. I may be obnoxiously wealthy, but I try my best to understand what I have, what I can give, and what others need. I drive into a three-car garage, which is a real luxury in this Philly area, and I park next to Jane's baby blue Volkswagen Beetle. My car clock blinks 8:12 a.m. before I shut off the ignition. Pharaoh already unclips his seatbelt and tucks the folded papers into his back pocket. He acts like he's just visiting, but my bodyguard is moving in. That's right. This isn't a welcome to my life sitcom. This is a you've joined my life drama, or possibly a horror story. It's too soon to tell which. At least we're not about to be roommates. Above this garage are two identical townhouses that sit side by side and share an adjoining door on the first floor, all for easy access. Security stays in the right townhouse. Jane and I stay in the left one. Pharaoh barely even takes a second to digest his surroundings. I know that he knows he's moving in. There are two suitcases and a black duffel in my trunk to prove it. I unbuckle. "Do you need anything else?" I can pick up something for you at the store. I almost groan at myself. Why the hell am I asking Pharaoh this? I'm on automatic and someone needs to switch me to manual, quick. He pauses, his hand on the door handle. As he glances at me, his lips rise.
That's cute that you're pretending you can go to the store without me.
I wasn't pretending. I pocket my keys and push open my door. I just omitted the fact. For my own sanity, I'm highly aware that Pharaoh is now obligated to follow me everywhere. Highly aware. I can't exactly pretend that this 27-year-old tattooed guy is some random barnacle that attached itself to my ship. He's my fucking co-captain right now. And I'm not thrilled. In case I didn't make that vitally clear. We climb out of the Audi and shut our doors in unison. I pop the trunk, and while I grab his largest suitcase, I tell him, I retract my offer.
That's too bad,
Pharaoh says in a serious tone, slinging his duffel on his shoulder.
I forgot shampoo and conditioner.
You can borrow mine. Jesus fucking Christ. I growl at myself, wanting to be an asshat to him for at least 2 seconds. Pharaoh laughs like he won.
I just now remember. I have shampoo and conditioner.
I glare and remove his second suitcase while holding the other. You're an asshole.
You're pure of heart. What else is still the same?
Pharaoh tries to take the larger suitcase from me. I tug it out of his grip. I can carry it for you.
He gives me a look. You're not earning a Valor merit badge. I can carry my own shit.
He adjusts the strap of his duffel.
But to be kind, I'll let you roll in the little one.
Oh, thanks, I say dryly, and then I shove the little one in his chest and keep the larger one. We're two alpha males, and it becomes extremely apparent during these pointless fights where we want to carry the heavier suitcase. I'm just used to helping out, especially since I have a large extended family and I'm the oldest guy. And Pharaoh, his whole job, his whole upbringing has been about duty and aid towards others. We're like lightning and thunder. Inherently different, but alike enough to share the same sky. Pharaoh doesn't argue for the larger suitcase. So I shut my trunk. You remember which is which? I nod to the two entrances. He's been here before as my mom's bodyguard. Pharaoh keeps his gaze on mine.
Left door goes to Azkaban. Right to Mordor.
I stare at him like he just grew antlers. I'm the one who cracks the pop culture references. Pharaoh doesn't even like fantasy. He tolerates it like someone who hates mayo and eats it on a turkey sandwich. You've been hanging around my mom too long? I question. I have comic book loving, pop culture obsessed parents. The coolest. I'm sure the two Meadows girls and the seven Cobalt children would protest and say their parents are cool, but there's no comparison. Hands down, mine are the goddamn best. Pharaoh slowly licks his bottom lip into a smile. My muscles contract, and I try to focus on his eyes and not his mouth. Not his mouth.
No, he says. It's an inside joke with the whole security team.
I'm surprised he's sharing this with me. Seriously? He nods, and we head to the right door, what he called Mordor.
I was told that this one started with your little brother. His bodyguard repeated the joke to another bodyguard, and it spread.
I could see Xander making a comment about Harry Potter and the Lord of the Rings, easily. We head up the few stairs, and I wait on one below him and place the suitcase on its wheels. Pharaoh searches for his key in his pocket.
Declan didn't talk to you that often, did he?
I go still, my apprehension filling the garage. In hindsight, I wonder if I was supposed to make a greater effort to know my bodyguard personally. Was I being rude? What if all that time he wanted me to pry into his fucking life, and I thought I was just respecting his space? Declan knew everything about me. The world knows most everything about me. And I only knew the names of his kids and wife. Almost nothing else. Pharaoh peeks back at me and assesses my features.
It's okay if you didn't.
I remember the origin of his question. He didn't spill any security team secrets, if that's what you're asking. Pharaoh finds his key, but he rotates fully to face me.
Let's deal with this, Moffy.
Maximoff. I correct,
my voice firm like solid marble. All of my family calls me Mafi, but when he uses the nickname, I flash back to childhood where he called me that. It makes our 5-year age gap more apparent, and when I imagine my young teenage self in bed with him, which only happened in my fantasies, it's cringeworthy. So he's not allowed to call me Mafi. Done and done.
Maximov, he says, like I'm being a stick-in-the-mud prick.
What are we dealing with exactly? I put the train back on the tracks before he catches my actual reasons.
What I share with you, they're not secrets. At least half of us don't consider them secrets. The other half are so uptight they could be mistaken for the Queen's Guard outside Buckingham Palace.
So you're pretty much like a rebel in the security team. I give him a blatant once-over, eyeing his tattoos, the black wardrobe, the piercings. All this time, I had no idea.
Pharaoh lets out a short laugh into an agitated, amused smile, nodding a few times.
I think smartass sits on his tongue, and then his gaze falls to my lips for the briefest second. Before I even process what that means, he acts like nothing transpired, and he starts to unlock the door. It could have just been in my head. I'm prone to fantasizing. What's to say I didn't invent that out of the horny recesses of my sexually frustrated brain? I need to go out and find a one-night stand tonight. It's my first thought. My second jarring thought slaps me cold. Pharaoh has to come with me. I can't escape him. For pretty much all of eternity.
4. Pharaoh Keen. Luggage in hand, I lead the way up 2 flights of narrow wooden stairs. Much to Maximov's chagrin, I'm certain he'd love to be the one leading the non-existent pack, but he has to be second place to me this time. And really, every time as far as I'm concerned. It's not just me being pompous or arbitrarily arrogant. For his safety, he has to learn to let me lead. Thick silence stretches while we both ascend the stairs. I'm not used to uncomfortable tension, and I doubt he is either. See, I didn't ask to be his bodyguard. I didn't apply for the position or submit an application. I fell into the role at his mom's request. I like change. I welcome change. But when one of my favorite pastimes is pissing off Maximov Hale, I'm not so sure I'd have volunteered for this job. Another tense beat passes between us before Mafi warns me, "Your room is small." I end up smiling because I've been in these 2 townhouses multiple times. They're identical. Second floor has 2 bedrooms and the only bath. Third floor is an attic bedroom. Everything else is crammed on the first floor. Maximov lives in the 3rd floor attic inside the other townhouse. A room barely big enough for a full-sized bed, a bookshelf, and a dresser. I'm about to live in the identical version of that same attic room. I can manage. It's the same size as yours. I glance back at him. Only 2 stairs below me, one of the most beloved celebrities stands confident and agitated at my heels. And he has my 50-pound suitcase easily hoisted on his shoulders like a soldier carrying a rucksack. He's not flaunting his strength. With Mafi, he's just being efficient, giving himself more room to walk up the narrowest staircase imaginable. His carved biceps stretch the fabric of his green tee. I smile. I'm sure most people would faint at his feet right now, possibly stammer, maybe try to seduce him, say all the right things in the right way. Instead, he has me. If only your grammar were as good as your weightlifting skills, I tell him, you'd be a real contender. If only your wit was actually funny, I'd be laughing. I smile wider. I wasn't trying to make you laugh, Wolf Scout. Mafi groans out his irritation, but his lips slowly rise. He scrunches his face until his features set in a scowl. Feel better? I ask and keep ascending the stairs. He'd flip me off if he had use of his hands, but he never falters with the suitcase, never struggles. Many tabloids rank Maximov Hale as the #1 hottest celeb. It's accurate. He has eyes like blades of grass, a jawline just as sharp, features so striking that he's already a treasured marble relic before adding his statuesque, out-of-this-fucking-world body. And he's entered my thoughts in ways that Disney wouldn't permit. It started 3 years ago, during his first semester of college. I'd just become his mom's personal bodyguard, and she attended one of his swim meets. I sat on the bleachers and watched as he pulled himself out of the collegiate pool, Ivy League banners hanging overhead, Latin insignias scrawled on free wall space. His muscles flexed when he stood straight and confident at 6'2". Pulling his goggles to his head, water dripped down the ridges of his tan skin. His legs were more muscular, shoulders broader. He looked older. I remember thinking, Maximoff Hale is a man. After that, his image basically invaded my mind during personal moments. Being his mom's bodyguard didn't really stop me from envisioning Maximoff naked and bent over a bed. Things happen. People pop into your head when you're rubbing one out. I'm just glad I have good taste. When I discovered that I was assigned to his security detail, I didn't fixate on the fact that I'm attracted to him. It's irrelevant. I could have a framed photograph of him that I jack off to every night. I don't. And I'd still do my job at 100%. I'm a damn good bodyguard. One of the best. And nothing and no one will change the fact that I'm going to protect him. While silence blankets us again, I reach the top of the staircase where a single door lies. I enter my new room with Maximoff close behind. I let out a long whistle. You decided to warn me that it's small but not hot and musty? I toss my luggage beside my full bed and test the springs with my boot. It'll do. Nothing but a mattress and box springs. Moffy drops my suitcase by the door. I'll check the AC. You don't need to. I rub my mouth, my lip piercing cold. Of course, saying it's hot would make him want to fix the temperature. I appreciate the concern, but this is where you have to stop treating me like a guest or a sibling or really anyone you feel the need to coddle and protect. I hold his strong gaze. And heat rises. We're in an attic. I've never known that before, he says dryly. I've just been living in the other attic for 3 years thinking, why the fuck does it feel like hell's sauna? Thank God you're here to share this unfound wisdom. I have to lean on the brick wall, my smile killing me. Sarcasm is just written in his DNA, equipped with verbal pitchforks at birth. I gesture him onward with my hand. Keep going. I'm done. I roll my eyes before standing off the interior brick wall. They're all brick, I realize. No mold, luckily. But the wooden ceiling rafters look like they haven't been dusted in a decade. I waft my shirt from my chest. It must be 90 degrees in here. It's August in Philly. Summer heat's still present. But with the AC cranked low, downstairs is a freezer in comparison to the attic. I'm about to open the only window, but Moffy already aims for the windowsill, completely ignoring my earlier speech. I tilt my head upward, restraining another eye roll. He has no idea that I spent 6 hours being debriefed this morning about him and the entrances, exits, and windows of the two townhouses. Omega's recommendation? Try to keep him away from windows. I'm not in a gated neighborhood anymore. Windows face public streets, which means anyone can whip out a camera, point a lens upward, and try to film him. Moffy's 44th rule. I open my own windows. And there lies the discord. His mom welcomed all the airbags that kept her safe, but Moffy would rather live his life as unrestricted as possible. It's considered dangerous. See, a very small space exists between freedom and safety for celebrities. I fight to give that middle ground to a client, especially for someone like Maximoff, who wants that freedom. But the more he tries to protect himself, the more we're going to have a problem. He can't be his own bodyguard. It's impossible. For every window you open, I get two, I tell him. He pauses by the windowsill. Why the hell would I agree to a lopsided ratio that's in your favor? Because 1-2 is better than 1-3. He licks his lips. How about 1-1? I swing my head from side to side, considering for less than a second. No. Yes. Fine, I concede early, surprising him, but I really just need him to let me in somewhere. 1-1 is better than 1-0. My job is about split-second choices that affect his life, and I subtly and quickly weigh risks. My window faces an overgrown magnolia tree that obstructs the street view. Also, if he cared about being caught on camera, he wouldn't actively go for the window right now. Conclusion? Risk equals low. Window equals have at it, Moffy. I keep an attentive eye on him and remove my black sheets and bedding from my duffel. Maximoff wrenches the crusted window open, muscles flexed. The old wood screeches as it reaches the top. When he returns to my mattress, he cracks his knuckles. Moffy scans my bedding, his phone buzzing in his jeans pocket, but it's been vibrating since I first saw him today. Earlier, I deduced that he's ignoring his texts. "Do you need a minute?" I ask.
"For what?"
He's rigid, but he always stands at attention like he's one breath from sprinting into a fight to save his family. I nearly smile. "A minute to let this sink in." He inhales a strong breath.
"Sure. Just change that minute to a century and I'm good."
I rest my knee on the mattress, my hand slipping in my pocket. "If I give you a century, you'll be dead."
"Great, you can garb my corpse."
My brows hike. "That's really adorable that you think I'll outlive you.
Who says you won't?
I'm 5 years older than you." I find a piece of gum in my pocket and peel the foil. "And I'm still taller than you too. By 1 inch.
I forgot that in your fucked up alternate universe, height determines one's life expectancy."
I laugh a short laugh and pop my gum in my mouth. We stand still on either side of my bed and neither of us really moves. I skim his wardrobe, just a green t-shirt, jeans, and a cheap canvas watch. He looks like he's worth 20 bucks, not over a billion. His quiet humility makes him seem even older. My eyes flit up to his, and he visibly tenses. "One of us needs to speak. Not jokingly. No humor. I rarely have serious conversations with him, and to be his bodyguard, our serious talks need to outweigh all the others." I rake both of my hands through my hair for the third time today, pushing the strands back. "What are your plans for tonight?" My words must wash over him like a bucket of ice water. He cringes, looks away, and shakes his head a few times.
"This is too fucking weird."
I slowly chew my gum, thinking of how to approach this.
I'm attaching myself to his life, not the other way around. I'd be just as irked if our positions were reversed.
"Help me make my bed," I say. Maximoff easily takes the detour and he motions for me to give him the corner of the sheet. I do. He'd never reject someone's request for help. I can't even remember the last time I asked him to help me with anything. Most likely never. We both hook my fitted sheet onto the corners of the mattress, and then I toss him a pillow in the black pillowcase. I stare at him for a long moment, and his daggered green eyes lift to my brown. We slow down, and neither of us needs to speak to be aware of the taut air. I know the source. He knows the source. It's sex. Sex is the untouched topic. Maximoff Hale is the most eligible bachelor in the country. It's public knowledge that he frequents nightclubs and bars. It's my job to hide how many one-night stands he has from the media. The security team gossips, but Declan never shared with anyone how many people Maximoff fucks. I'm now supposed to safeguard that mystery. And whoever he wants to sleep with, I have the distinct responsibility of not only meeting them, but interrogating them. I'll get them to sign a non-disclosure agreement. I'll stand guard at his bedroom in case something bad happens. I'll be there until they leave. I'll even escort them out of his townhouse. I'm the one who has to protect his cock and his heart. "You can trust me," I tell him. He shakes my pillow into its case.
"I have to trust you. There's a fucking difference."
I pop a bubble and tilt my head back and forth, considering both statements. "You'll see that you can trust me sooner rather than later. I work for you now. Not your mom." Those words loosen his shoulders a fraction. The whole security team often refers back to the parents since most of the Hale Meadows and Cobalt children are still underage. Out of fear of parental wrath and subsequent termination, many bodyguards would snitch on Maximoff in a heartbeat. I won't. I fear none of the parents or the possibility of being fired. 3 years, nearly 24 hours a day protecting his mom was no joke. She's shy, a sex addict, and her gangly build and soft features make her look perpetually young. Round cheeks, shoulder-length brown hair, and green eyes like Moffy. Hecklers see her as an easy target. I've been spit in the face numerous times. I'm taking right hooks to the jaw, uppercuts to the ribs, all meant for her. I've broken a fucker's cheekbone and was subsequently sued, though he was the one who tried to reach beneath her dress. I've disarmed gunmen, knife carriers, and hecklers wielding plastic water pistols, bags of glitter, dildos, any hard projectiles. I've driven Lily out of passionate crowds that rocked her car. I've cleared thousands of rooms and bathrooms before she entered. I've made sure no one in the fucking world would put a hand on her. I live by my actions, and my actions say, I'm the best at whatever I do. And if someone really wants to fire me, they would have done it years ago when I turn off my comms and leave blanks in my daily where-did-you-go-and-what-did-you-do write-ups. That standard practice serves more to ignite gossip in the security